You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, October 5th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
In the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, journalist Melissa Etihad, who's been at the United Nations for this week of General Assembly meetings, addresses in New York City that have clogged up our streets with all sorts of obnoxious convoys and vehicles and blah, 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 blah. But there have been some important speeches there, some important movements on the globe, and Melissa and I are going to talk about it. What else we got, Matt?
Also, I will be speaking with David Futrell of We Hunted the Mammoth, great website that basically tracks and writes about what's going on in the manosphere. That's right. We'll be exposing men's rights activists today, folks, and we on the Majority Report.
And we have a poll as to what's more disturbing, what's happening in Syria or in the men's rights internet.
We're at Paul Elam's bar hopping this past
Dude,
weekend.
I refuse to learn that guy's name. I don't know who you're talking about. All right, man. There's only so much I can do. Only so much I can take. Also, Carly Fiorina, she's probably the worst person in the Republican field. And that is really saying something. And she's got some interesting new bio arguments for herself as to why she's the one to take on ISIS. And I'm beginning to get why, even though she's not really actually good at anything, she became a corporate CEO, because this woman knows how to apple polish a resume.
Speaking of someone who doesn't know how to polish anything, we'll be also talking about Jeb Bush's latest flub, whatever you want to call it. And it, you know, it's like it was like one flub, and then he was asked about it. Chance to fix it, buddy. Nope. Second flub. Okay, you have one more chance to fix it, and then just boom, nuke your political ambitions right then and there.
Subconsciously, he cannot possibly want to be president. But I know that everybody listening to this show that shaves, both consciously and subconsciously, wants to have a great shaving experience, okay? I know some of you watch the show, watch YouTube. You know I go in and out. Sometimes I've got a full beard. Sometimes, like today, I'm sleek, clean-shaven. It's hard. It grows fast, and it's thick. You got to take care of it. And razors, the markup, if you go to the drugstore on just like a normal, I'm not talking like this quattro, triple, blah, 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 like you need to like razor somebody up because you're in a prison camp. I'm talking like, you know, a normal razor at a drugstore is way overpriced. It's crazy. It brings out my inner Sam Steeter voice. Okay, it's crazy. I don't want to spend that. That's why, thank God, we have today's sponsors. Today's sponsor, that's Harry's Razor, man. Harry's Razors. It's a no-brainer. Harry's, look, here's what they'll give you, okay? For about the half the price of other big branded blades, and they ship it to you free to your front doorstep, right? We all know shaving can be a pain. It can be uncomfortable, cause razor burns, nicks. And on top of all of that, as I already said, it's outrageously expensive. Okay? So for about half the price Harry sends it to you right to your front door. Okay? And they're better, too. I can attest to that. I shaved with the Harry's this morning right before I came on air. Okay? The first blades were made in Germany. You know Germans are good at stuff like that. And they like them so much, Harry's just bought an entire factory there. I look forward to being able to make life decisions like that.
Oh, I'll just buy the factory.
But seriously, Harry's tried these German razors and they were just like, ah, yeah, bought the factory. Done. Why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades? It's half the price at Harry's. And with Harry's, you'll get a better shave that respects your skin, face, legs, and your wallet. It's a no-brainer. No more poor quality blades and no pesky plexiglass cabinets to unlock either. It's ridiculous. These kid-proof plexiglass nonsense for overpriced razors that you're going to throw out in a couple of weeks anyways. These Harry's razors last a long time. The starter set is an amazing deal of $15. You get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. And with promo code MajorityReport, you get 5 off of that amazing offer. Okay? That's unbelievable. That's $10. Men, women, we all need razors. And a shave that, well, doesn't suck. And I can tell you, I mean, it's clean, it's fast, no cuts. Doom, boom, you're good to go. It just couldn't be easier, okay? Never make another trip to the drugstore again. It's shipped right to your door. You have a great shave. It comes in a nice box, too. It's easy to deal with. You can take it to the gym with you, wherever you need it. It's incredible. It really is a great product. Go to harrys.com now, and Harry's will give you 5 off if you type in promo code MajorityReport. That's promo code MajorityReport. That's harrys.com. Enter the promo code MajorityReport and check it out for $5 off. Start shaving better today. President Obama throwing in a little bit there for Harry's. All right, folks, we are going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Melissa Etahad on the Majority Report.
Gangsta love, just like Steve Miller. They wear skivvies that's made of chinchilla. Factory in Mexico, Bronx, Spring Villa. I'm from the land where the Panthers grew. You know the city and the avenue. If you the boss, we'll be smabbing through and we'll be grabbing you. Just say what's up with the revenue. Yeah, and if you're feeling, we can even try to sell it with the bomb. You wait to kill a CEO. Slap him up and shake him up, and then you know. Set him off the floor, then bait him with the dough. You can do it funk or do it disco.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Melissa Etahad. She is an independent journalist based in New York City. Her writing has appeared in Al Jazeera, Mondo Weiss, Iran Wire, and many other publications. Melissa, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Michael, for having me.
One second, Melissa. You are on now. Go ahead. Sorry.
Thanks, Michael. No, it's all good. Thanks for having me. How's it going?
It's my pleasure. It's going really well. And I know that you were following what was happening very closely at the UN this past week. And we want to get to some of the kind of main themes that emerged. And it seems like the first place that we should start is this contrast that really got laid out in American versus Russian policy in Iran, and potentially also maybe even a split between, in Syria rather, but maybe potentially also a split between Russia and Iran with regards to Syria. But before we get to that, tell us what President Obama was saying about Syria in his address versus what President Putin was saying and how that is playing out.
Definitely. So it was really interesting because during the opening of the UNGA, essentially Obama and Putin criticized each other, especially in their war in Syria and the subsequent refugee crisis. Obama called out Putin for defending the Syrian government, essentially saying that he ignored international rules and how they want to impose order through military force. Putin essentially rebutted and said that, you know, the Assad regime represents stability. His force is needed to fight ISIS. And it's interesting because Putin also mentioned how he wants to create an international coalition to fight ISIS. And Rouhani, Iranian president, echoed, you know, how he agrees with this. So it's definitely interesting to note those two differences of what happened in the UN last week.
So moving out from that, would you say that there is So it seems like basically President Obama's position and the U.S. position has obviously always been very convoluted on Syria. And I think what's emerging, what's really difficult here, because first of all, it is important to bear in mind that the Assad regime is still a prime factor in human rights abuses and all sorts of sort of humanitarian catastrophes that are the norm in Syria. So we're not just talking about ISIS when we're talking about human rights abuses in Syria. We're not just talking about the Free Syrian Army. We're still very much talking about the Assad government. But it seems like what the U.S. is saying is that we oppose ISIS, we oppose Assad, we support this kind of amorphous Free Syrian Army, which we don't really have control over. We don't really understand exactly even how it operates and who's on whose side, essentially. And it seems like fundamentally what Putin is doing for all of the rhetoric about ISIS is he's just coming in and saying, we are propping a Russian client state, period. I mean, is that really like the genuine read on what's going on with when you take away all of the sort of theatrics about ISIS from the Russian side?
So Putin definitely has international and domestic reasons for interfering in Syria. And we can see that because he has military bases that he wants to, you know, maintain control over. And on the international front, you know, this is a way to prop up Russian regional influence and power.
Right.
And, you know, from the U.S. point of view, Obama has been reluctant to act. And, you know, he hasn't, you know, when the red lines have been crossed, he hasn't done much. You know, and I think it's just reflective of how the U.S. administration never really intended to get dragged into the complexities of Syria. Is it in the U.S. national interest? And I feel like, you know, it is. We have a right in the U.S. to stand for our human rights and to make sure that, you know, the Assad regime and ISIS, to make sure the people are okay. But U.S. foreign policy has never been really representative of standing for human rights, in my opinion.
Sure. I mean, sort of opening it up, you've also said, and you noted that there's a process that we obviously all just saw, where the P5 plus one concluded a deal with Iran on that country's nuclear program that was internationalized, that involved a lot of the same players, obviously, that are involved in Syria, the United States, Europe, Iran, Russia. Mm-hmm. There was negotiations a couple of years ago, and there have been ongoing negotiations in Geneva and other places trying to bring some type of settlement to the Syrian situation. And it seems like in the past, the intransigence of Assad, the United States sort of setting out this notion that he's not going to be part of any final outcome, even though it seems clear that practically speaking, you know, he will be, in fact. Is there been any type of possibility raised about updating that process, updating the P5 plus one to bring to light on Syria?
So last week there was kind of like an emerging consensus that there should be a P5 plus one negotiating model to engage Iran and other countries on the Syria conflict. Rouhani also expressed how he wants this. And, you know, Obama is prepared to work with Russia to broker a deal. And it's funny because it seems like this week something new is that he's not made a precondition for Assad's departure.
That's a big precondition.
Within the framework they're discussing.
Okay.
So if Putin is willing to talk with Assad and Iran to help bring about a political transition, I imagine the U.S. Would engage in that kind of dialogue.
Right. And I've also heard, just before we sort of pivot here, that there is some difference between Russia and Iran with regard to Assad, that there's a distinction between how committed Russia is to Assad, which it is committed to keeping that government in place some way, shape, or form, but less committed to him sort of presiding over the country in full, whereas in Iran, there's a kind of much more adamant commitment in preserving Assad's full position. So we'll see how that plays out. The other thing that was also really important in this past week's meetings have been the reverberations from another aspect of Syria, obviously, which is this refugee crisis, which is always important to note that is sort of nothing new. It's ongoing, and it's certainly affected Jordan and Lebanon, their surrounding countries. But now it's affecting Europe greatly, and we're seeing really divergent policy responses to that, including some really disturbing ones in places like Hungary. Hungary's foreign minister, I don't know the foreign minister's name, and I frankly refuse to learn the foreign minister's name. But you noted this as well, that during the foreign minister's address at the General Assembly, that there was a really important language differentiation in terms of how they were framing the issue at the General Assembly.
Yeah, so I sat in on Sunday at the UNGA, and I listened to what the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and he's also the Foreign Trade of Hungary, and he was basically describing the mass migration movement as a migration movement, not in terms of a refugee crisis. And that really speaks to, how Hungary wants to view it to solve the problem. You know, in order to come to a solution about how to help these refugees, which is a humanitarian crisis, there needs to be a consensus on how to frame what's happening. And, you know, the Maldives foreign minister went up after Hungary spoke and called out what the Hungary foreign minister was saying, basically saying we need to call it what it is, a crisis with refugees. And media outlets have also begun to refer to it as a refugee crisis. Al Jazeera in August said it wasn't going to refer to it as a Mediterranean migrant crisis anymore. There's a petition on BBC to start referring to it as a refugee crisis. And it's disturbing to hear how Hungary is still referring to it as a migrant crisis. But even afterwards, towards the end of his speech, he was like, this is not an issue regarding Muslim faith. We want to stress, he wanted to stress how it has nothing to do with Islam. But I feel like, you know, in some level, the Hungarian foreign prime minister, Orban, definitely evokes sentiments that make it seem very Islamophobic.
Mm-hmm. I think that in all of Europe, there's definitely very strong anti-immigrant politics that applies to Muslims and non-Muslims, and ironically actually applies like in a place like the UK. It also applies to people coming from Eastern Europe, right? So it's definitely not Islam specific, but obviously Islam is part of it. And even when you hear people talking about things like civilizational values, that's very apparent. But I think, did you get a sense? I mean, you said that there was a response from the Maldives. Was there a broader kind of pushback at the UN? Because, you know, it might appear superficial, but these language things are very important. I mean, as an example, going back to the 1990s, the Clinton administration's policy to not call what was happening in Rwanda a genocide was a quite conscious policy choice to not kind of evoke the international obligations and responsibilities that come with using that word. So migrant versus refugee is a very important distinction. And of course, these people coming from Syria are obviously refugees. So was there a kind of broader pushback? Was Germany still, I guess, kind of carrying the flag on that issue?
So just to take it back a bit, I think to define the term like migrant. So migrant means is a term associated with people who move for work, choosing to leave the country, right? And refugee is designated term for someone who's forced to flee. So in that sense, I think just people in the UN, you know, I heard a comment from someone who was working with the Irish delegation, and he mentioned to me that, you know, he was shocked at the Hungarian Minister of Foreign Affairs rhetoric.
Right.
So I think that's where things are at right now. People are just disturbed.
And before we wrap up, do you have any thoughts on Bibi Netanyahu staring down the UN? And please don't try to make a joke about it, because the visual won't work on air.
Oh, my goodness. So Netanyahu's speech, the part where he was just silent for 45 seconds.
Right.
I mean, it's just theatrics at the end of the day.
So just to be clear, he actually went up on stage and stared down the UN because he said, "You've all been silent about Iran's," and, you know, granted, really deplorable rhetoric about my country. And then he glared down the UN chamber. That's
right,
basically what he
exactly.
did. Yeah. Okay. Just so everybody
completely
knows.
Completely silent. And the question that I feel like it's important to ask is what benefit does he have by sneering at this international community? Right? Like, is he gaining anything by doing this? And the answer is no.
Right.
The reality is that Iran has resumed business with Western states. And instead of focusing on Palestinian issue, which is right in his backyard, he's talking about Iran. And it goes back to this idea that Netanyahu needs an existential threat to survive.
Right.
And so he's conjuring images of an external enemy. And you know, Iran hasn't attacked anyone for over 200 years. Yes, they are involved in proxy wars. And, you know, the Iranian regime has done horrific things to their own people, human rights abuses and whatnot. Definitely not justifying that. But we've seen even people within Israel come out in support of the deal. Like Ami Ayalon, the former director of Israel's Shin Bet.
Right.
Numerous other people.
Yes. And go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You're exactly right. And I just want, right before we wrap up, I just wanted to also raise what is really interesting that happened in that speech is that Netanyahu also, he did mention the Palestinians, and he said Abbas was not a partner for peace, which is, you know, whatever your criticisms of Mahmoud Abbas, and I have many, you know, it's clear that the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank is the only political faction right now in Israel-Palestine that actually is still committed to any type of two-state peace process. Hamas is not enrolled in that process, and clearly the Israeli government, this present Israeli government, is not, as they continue mm-hmm. to construct settlements. Ehud Olmert, who was Israel's prime minister from 2006 to 2009, who is actually awaiting, it looks like, going to jail on a corruption conviction, was a very interesting Israeli politician, very complicated figure. But he gave an interview to Al Jazeera just this past weekend where he said he has problems with the Iran agreement, but Israel has to accept it and not try to embarrass the United States or President Obama, who he also said had been a great friend to Israel. And he also said that Mahmoud Abbas was absolutely a partner for peace. So mm-hmm. I guess your final thought is what I'm curious is that we have an Israeli leader who is about to go to prison, but he's the one who seems like way more aligned with reality than the one that they have now.
Exactly. And Netanyahu could have used his time during the speech to encourage a peace plan. And instead, he decided to, direct blame at his rival. It's not a sign of leadership. And I think a sign of leadership is one that we're seeing with other Israeli politicians who have concerns about the Iran deal, but at the same time realize that it's an important step forward.
Absolutely. Well, Melissa Etahad, independent journalist based in New York City. You can see her writing at any number of places, including Al Jazeera, Mondo Weiss, many more. There's a link to your work on our website at majority.fm. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Great chatting with you.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, folks. You got like a couple of minutes before this guy comes on, right?
Yeah, but we could switch our
– I feel like
you mean
I –
say something about it?
Well – I wish there was a shower nearby. Because, see, I just got to say, as we round up on this, and I've gotten into this because I got dragged into Gamergate at one point, but I know it sometimes I've been like, oh my God, I cannot deal with another men's rights conversation. And it's actually not because I don't take what Matt does with it seriously. It's because... It literally makes me so physically nauseous that I'm like, can you please give me a break?
There's got to be like a Michael cam for just when MRA conversations happen.
That's it. You see it.
I do see it.
You see my reactions off camera. And I'm just like, dude, seriously?
I don't think it's so much disgust from Michael, though. I think it's just more like him just being absolutely shocked that like it exists.
There's probably a mix of shock, condescension, and revulsion. It's probably those three things.
There we go.
Because I have the impulse that on one hand, I want to be like a life coach for these guys. Like, go get yourself a Harry's razor. Go work out. Enjoy yourself. And then I'm also disgusted and mortified by the misogyny. And then I'm also just mind blown by
it. And the thing that really
that you could be that angry.
The thing that really interests me even more so in recent months and years.
Yes.
Is that, this used to be something you go online, oh, look at this like online like area of the web, like this area of the internet where I can go and see this.
Right.
But like it's weird how it's creeping. So just out of the blue almost.
Yeah.
Just it's creeping into the everyday national conversation and politics. I mean, have you ever heard of the terms beta and cuck outside of like sort of stuff?
Yeah, dude. I only knew what these words were because of you. And now they're all over the place. You're exactly right.
Yeah. And
you're
like,
exactly right.
That's why I think it's important to talk about this stuff because it's not just, oh, look at the men's rights activists on the internet. It's funny to look at. It's funny to talk about. It's like, no, these guys are actually spreading their message and it's becoming part of the everyday conversation. And then other areas of the pockets of the web are picking up on it too.
It would frankly be beta male of us to not expose them.
Yes, exactly.
All right. We're going to take a brief 30 second. We'll be right back with Dave Futrell. That's his name?
Yep.
All right. Be right back. Majority.fm.
anymore.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder, and joining us now, I am so happy to have this guy on because I've been a fan of his work for some time now. David Futrell of WeHuntedTheMammoth.com, exposing men's rights activists. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, sure. I'm really glad to be on. I guess this is the first time we've actually spoken to each other.
This is, yes.
And congrats on your new gig.
Thank you so much.
You're moving to an isolated location in Siberia with no internet access, is what I understand. So we'll never hear from you again.
That's right. I'm gone. That's
excellent.
It. Never again will I be talking about men's rights activism, which actually would sort of be a dream come true for some.
But possibly for you, if they vanish off the face of the earth tomorrow, that would.
I think they would enjoy that actually more so than I would. I get too much joy out of these guys. But I wanted to have you on especially because obviously I want to talk to you about what you've been doing. And you know what? Maybe we should start there for people who aren't quite aware what WeHuntedTheMammoth.com is. Why don't you give our listeners a quick, you know, a little bit of a summary, a rundown of what you've been doing for all these years?
It has been. It's been 5 years now. It's a blog, a daily blog, where I look at basically the men's rights movement, misogynistic pickup artists, men going their own way, this sort of what I call the new misogyny online. It's a fairly widespread movement, and though the people who are involved in it may call themselves different things, and someone who's an MRA or men's rights activist may be shocked and horrified if you suggest that they have anything in common with pickup artists. But the fact is, they share probably about 90% of their beliefs. It's this weird and very elaborate misogynistic belief system with its own sort of language and folk beliefs and mythology, most of which is completely false. So I've been basically tracking them for 5 years and documenting the things that they say and on rare occasions the things that they do, because they don't actually do very much. And and making fun of them when it's appropriate and, sort of being appalled by them when it's appropriate.
I think what you've been doing is actually an amazing resource, especially today in the year 2015, because you have been covering this for so long and have so much of this archived. And what I've been noticing recently, and I was just talking to Michael before we got you on the line, is that I've been noticing more and more that what's been happening in this manosphere has been, seeping out into other I guess you can say, online reactionary movements. And even further than that, I mean, we see these terms that were primarily used in these men's rights activists, men going their own way, pickup artist communities, like, you know, beta male and cuck and all this sort of terminology. We're seeing it seep not only into things like, you know, Gamergate and, you know, online white supremacist movements. We're seeing it even in today's everyday politics in terms of we have your run-of-the-mill Republican or conservative using terms like cuck to call people cuckservatives.
Right, right. No, and it's interesting because I think I mean, that's always the question I have with these guys is you know, to what degree are the guys I'm writing about how widespread are these beliefs? Is it really just a tiny minority of really loud and obnoxious guys online? Or, you know, if when you're walking down the street, you know, in any group of five guys you see, is one or two of them secretly a men's rights activist and who believes all this? And, you know, I think it's in between the two. But you're right that a lot of this this ideology is seeping beyond the borders of the manosphere. And I mean, you can see this in the discussions of the you know, the shooter in Oregon, in that you know, the terminology of beta males was being raised on 4chan and then talked about on CNN, and the idea that it's, that that is, the shooting was sort of the beginning of a beta male revolution, and. We're going to hear more about that, I'm sure, as the months go by, particularly since there are people on 4chan who were inspired by the shooting to start posting their own threats. Like, there was one, posted about, Edinburgh, in Scotland, and then a more recent one, a threat very similar to the threat that was, or the warning that was left apparently by the shooter on 4chan before he went and shot up murdered people in Oregon. There was one warning people in the Philadelphia, warning students in the Philadelphia area that today someone would show up with a gun and start shooting.
You know, it's interesting you bring up 4chan because it's almost like, I mean, everyone knows 4chan as this, you know, this internet community where all this, like, you know, toxic trolling goes on. But, like, I remember 4chan in the earlier days of the internet. Like, trolling was always a thing online, and it lived and breathed on 4chan. But to me, trolling was sort of like, you know, these edgy, maybe sometimes they would cross the line in terms of racism or sexism. But when it came down to it, they were like internet pranks. Like, I remember one of the earliest, like, 4chan episodes of trolling to really go viral is, like, they logged into some video game, online game, like, I think it was called, like, Habbo Hotel, and they created all these characters to block the in-game pool, like swimming pools, from anyone who is a black avatar. Like, that's stupid, but when it comes down to it, harmless. And and somewhere, trolling became stuff like that, internet, making fun of people on the internet, but never really crossing that line, to straight up harassment, getting fake stories out there so the news thinks that someone else is the Oregon shooter or whatever shooting we're talking about. So to me, it's amazing that this sort of trolling has sort of just become something that that's seeped through all these different reactionary movements, especially the men's rights areas of the internet.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the trolling is becoming more nihilistic, and I guess you'd call it darker now than it has been. And I think in general that this manosphere, or, you know, new misogyny, whatever you want to call it, online is also picking up more from that. I mean, I think Gamergate brought a lot of that sort of nihilistic, cruel, dark trolling to a lot of people in the men's rights movement and in this general sphere. I mean, a lot of men's rights activists were involved in it or tried in some ways to associate themselves with Gamergate. And I mean, Gamergate, the folks in Gamergate, not all of them, but a significant enough portion of them engage in this really dark and nihilistic trolling. That And it's but you know, and instead of you know, doing something silly in an online game, they will, you know, arrange to have SWAT teams show up at people's houses, and will launch campaigns to ruin the reputation of people that they don't like. And so I don't know what to do about that exactly. It's something I've been observing for a while. The other thing that's happening that's, that kind of is a similarly disturbing trend is basically the spread of a lot of white supremacist ideas.
Yes.
Yes. Into Gamergate and into the manosphere more broadly. Like a lot of the people that, that I, when I started my blog, they were mainly writing about pickup artists, you know, how to pick up women, like someone like Roosh.
You know, but before we get any further with the white supremacist stuff, let's actually, because I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who are listening to these terms and they're thinking MRA, pickup artist, men going the MGT,
right.
Like what is that? So let's first break down these terms, I guess. So an MRA or men's rights activist is basically what?
They're kind of the most conventional of the bunch. Men's rights activist is someone who has convinced himself that that the male gender is the gender that's truly oppressed these days. Maybe the men haven't been oppressed always, but you know, men are the ones, you know, that feminism came along and fixed all the problems for women and then swung too far in the opposite direction, and now men are the ones who are being oppressed.
Of course.
And so these are the guys who will actually occasionally talk about you know, like public policy issues, or you know, bring up things that are actually, you know, real things happening in the world, though they do so in a very weird and distorted way. The part of their name that's a real misnomer, though, is the activist part, because they essentially do no activism beyond yelling at people online and invading comment sections, and occasionally they will go out in the real world and post inflammatory posters. And that's about the extent of their real world activism. I mean, I've been writing about them for 5 years now, and in that, those 5 years, in the U.S., I think it's safe to say that men's rights activists have accomplished literally nothing of value for men who were struggling. In Canada, they've organized one small men's center in one town. And it's not clear exactly what that men's center even does.
Is this that center? I don't remember exactly the details, but like it was started by a men's rights guy, and the acronym for it was COCK or something like that.
No,
but you know what I'm talking about.
The group,
right?
I'm thinking of is I know what you're talking about. The group that I'm thinking of is a group called CAFE, which something. Canadians for Equality, something along those lines. The group you're thinking of isn't really a group at all. It's a personal project of a guy named John Hembling and a friend of his, Diana Davison, who are sort of they're kind of a breakaway sect from the larger A Voice for Men website.
Yes.
And group. They basically were kicked out. Partly because they had decided to form a group whose initials were COCK, which was too much for the A Voice for Men people. Though it's worth pointing out that the A Voice for Men people don't have problems with putting videos online where they yell about the allegedly smelly vaginas of feminists they don't like.
Yeah, we've covered that one here, and I know you saw that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's get to the next one. A PUA or a pickup artist?
Yeah, the pickup artist kind of started in the early 2000s, at least as kind of a movement that people in the wider culture heard of. And the idea there was that they had a set of techniques, some of them based on, you know, weird forms of hypnosis, and some of them based on just, you know, stuff that pickup artists had come up with to try to you know, get women into bed.
Uh-huh. I remember.
What happened?
I remember it sort of hit the mainstream because wasn't there like a show on VH1 with some guy named
History? Yeah, there was a book called The Game by a man named Neil Strauss, who was a writer who hung out with pickup artists for a while, and then the guy that he wrote about the most in his book was a guy who went by the name of Mystery, and he ended up getting a show on VH1 where they attempted to took guys who were basically geeks and tried to turn them into pickup artists. And, you know, I think it had a season or two a while ago.
Yeah.
But what happened is, you know, even as that subculture has kind of faded in general from the public consciousness, it's continued on, and it's kind of broken into two parts. There's one part full of people like Mystery who are essentially commercial pickup artists who run very expensive seminars, you know, and travel around the world doing that, and run boot camps, they call them, where they, you know, give a bunch of guys some pep talks and then, like, go out in the field with them by, you know, by going to a local mall and trying to pick up every woman that walks by. But then there's this other group of pickup artists, and that's the one that I've written the most about. Those are people like Rouge and another guy named Hartiste. And they talk about pickup. Rouge got his start with a series of books called Bang, which were, you know, rudimentary pickup guides, and including pickup guides for a number of different countries that he had visited. But this group
these
of
are the, these
pickup
are, these,
artists.
These are those series of books that are literally titled like something like How to Bang Women in Insert Country Here for each separate book.
Yeah, it's even more simple than that. It's like it's Bang Ukraine, you know, Bang Poland, Bang whatever, Bang Colombia.
Analysis that he came up with was that one, I forgot what country it was, but one of them was not good for picking up women because of the social safety net that country had was so good that it made it difficult to pick up women there.
Yeah, I mean his perpetual he went basically to Eastern Europe and traveled around there looking for the ideal slender white women of his dreams. But he also went to some Scandinavian countries and in Denmark he apparently had very little luck with women, and so he put out a guide called Don't Bang Denmark. I have no idea who would buy that, but apparently he's made money off of it. But the thing about him is that it's almost sort of misleading to talk about him primarily as a pickup artist, because he's a more general reactionary and misogynist, and most of the stuff he posts these days is, you know, ideological attacks on feminism and attacks on women, and he's increasingly been moving into the whole white supremacist realm as well. I mean, he posted a thing that repeated a lot of conspiracy theories about Jews controlling the world and, you know, other racist things. And the other people who are in that general area have been publishing a lot more explicitly racist and, you know, verging on neo-Nazi writings. And the neo-Nazi movement is sort of looking to them as a place to recruit. They're all sort of searching for bigger audiences.
Yeah.
So Rouge is trying to expand his audience by appealing to white supremacists, and white supremacists are trying to move into the pickup area to steal that audience back for themselves.
It's an overlap. That's just an overlap of an overlap of an overlap of all these different groups. And it's you know, you brought up, you know, the Jews control the media, and I completely forgot to even mention how even the conspiracy theory audience, like you even see it in Alex Jones's segments on his show. I mean, more and more he's talking about how men are being attacked in the media, and he's coming out with even products. Super male vitality. Drink this, become a real man.
Right.
I mean, that's not the Alex Jones that always was. That wasn't the Alex Jones. I mean, even if maybe he sort of had that in his tool shed, he never really went to that as much as he's been going to it.
He's definitely sort of jumped on it. And if you look at in the comment section on his website, on anything that deals even remotely with women, you will find an assortment of people spouting the exact same talking points as men's rights activists and these reactionary pickup artists do. It's the same ideology. I don't know if he started doing more men's rightsy type things and those types followed, you know, went to his website because of that, or if it went the other way around.
Yeah,
if you just noticed a lot of that in the comments.
Yeah. So let's get to that. Let's get to that last of the main, I guess, three men's online. This is my favorite one because this one to me is hilarious. Like this is one.
Yeah. This
is one where you could just sit back and laugh at these ones.
Yeah. The weird thing is you're talking about men going their own way.
Exactly.
Of course,
yes.
And the sort of weird, awkward acronym, MGTOW, that people now pronounce it MGTOW, so that's how you identify them easily. I mean, the weird thing is that of all these different groups at the moment, the MGTOWs are the ones who are the most successful. I think their weird movement has grown a lot faster. I mean, I think that the men's rights movement is kind of in a weird holding pattern. I think a lot of the pickup artist types are sort of tired of writing about pickup and tired of thinking about that and are trying to move to this more right-wing, semi-fascist or just outright fascist ideology. But the men going their own way have a big community on YouTube, and you know, people are talking about them more and more. And what the movement is about essentially is men saying that they don't need women, and that women are a bunch of dirty whores. And ostensibly, the idea is that they are sort of individualistic and you know, self-reliant, and they don't need to have anything to do with women. But in practice, what they do is they spend virtually all their time online complaining about women and complaining about most of them. I mean, most of them don't really want to give up women. They talk about dating and girlfriends and so on and so forth all the time. In addition to just sort of talking about women all the time. I mean, they actually probably talk more about women than the editors of Ms. Magazine do. Because that's basically what motivates their movement, is just this incredible hatred of women and frustration that women don't want to have anything to do with them.
You have to just love how a movement who's supposedly, you know, we don't need women, we go our own way. All they do is talk about women. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, I mean, if you go to their website, you know, if you went to a website of men, if you knew nothing about this movement and went to a website talking about men going their own way, I don't know, you might expect them to be talking about their hobbies. You know, they might have a whole thing devoted to, you know, well, I've got a model train set in my basement and this is what I'm really into, or video games or fishing. I don't know. Any of these, I mean, those are sort of stereotypical men's things, but I don't know, maybe they'd be into knitting too. I mean, just sort of doing what they want to do and living life on their own terms.
Yeah, and that sounds like a movement that can actually, you know, be pretty normal.
Yeah. I mean, and if it were defined that way, I mean, I guess I would consider myself a man going my own way.
Just chilling,
but of course
it's
not. I mean, it sounds great in a way. But in fact, no, they don't go anywhere. They're tied to women by this hatred. But it's a hatred mixed with desire, and that's what I think gives it its sort of added nasty punch, in that they're angry at women because women can say no to them, and women do say no to them. And that they can't sort of have women on their own, men's own terms. I mean, I think that this kind of sexual frustration is actually a major part of the motivation for not just men going their own way and obviously the pickup artists, but also for a lot of men's rights activists. And that's why there's so much focus on the alleged evils of false rape accusations, which they portray as being some kind of epidemic when it in fact is not. And, you know, that basically these are a bunch of guys who see that the way people talk about and handle sexuality and culture has changed, and people are more aware of, you know, what consent is and what consent isn't. And essentially these are a lot of guys who sort of, I think a lot of them think that they'll never have sex unless they can pull some really sleazy date rapey or, you know, just date rape, or could actually, if they can't date rape, they're never going to have sex. And so they get frustrated and angry.
You know, I really think that's just the perfect explanation of all this. It is absolutely, yes, without a doubt, what's going on here. And Michael, yeah. Michael, my co-host here, Michael, is saying, call Dick, because we've discussed this stuff many times in this office, and
right,
it's really the perfect and I want to bring Michael into this conversation because you've talked about that Breitbart writer who really has been, I think he's been a major, I mean, at first he just came in, he was just a run-of-the-mill techno-conservative type of guy. And I'm talking about Milo Yiannopoulos of Breitbart.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah, he really has come in, and I think he has been an extremely integral part in mingling your mainstream conservative Republican right-wing media and the sort of dark internet misogynist, sexist, white supremacist worlds. And
yeah.
And Michael came in today and he told me how he was listening to the Joe Rogan show. And
yeah,
Milo was on Joe Rogan's program. And, you know, Joe Rogan, very open to his guests, really into listening to all sorts of different viewpoints. He's not really conservative. He's not really liberal. I would say he's, I guess he's what you would think of when you think of someone who just listens to each viewpoint and then just comes to his own. I mean, that rare individual type of person,
right,
that way. And Michael, why don't you just tell the story you heard on the show, Michael? It's really hilarious to listen to.
No, it was just a clip from it. And I think it was interesting because I like Joe Rogan a lot, but he's definitely more sympathetic to some of this stuff than I am, and I think that they were kind of coasting along and probably making fun of some, you know, probably some dumb Twitter outrages and everything else. But then Rogan wasn't really getting at what was behind this guy's worldview, right? Like, you can agree with somebody on something, but you could be coming at it from a really different place. And then out of nowhere, he said, what is his name again?
Milo.
Milo said something about how, like, you know, Christian nations are best, something to that effect. And Rogan was basically, wait a second, like, you're gay, dude. Like, what are you talking about? And then Milo Yiannopoulos was like, basically ended up saying, yeah, I'd be a better person if I wasn't gay. And,
right,
and Rogan was like, that's, you know, incredibly self-hating. And he said, no, it's not. And this was a sort of dramatic, but it was also such a troll moment too, because he knows when he says that's going to get clipped up. But I just thought it was interesting watching Rogan realize, like, oh, this is a different ball game. This isn't just like people who, you know, don't have a sense of humor on Twitter or whatever I think it is. This is,
right,
actually something that's really dark and weird and out there, and I didn't even get that. And all of a sudden it's exploding in my face, and now I'm pissed off because I don't want to co-sign on this. At least that's how I interpreted it.
I think that's the case with that. When you start scratching these people, they end up turning out to have a lot of racist assumptions or homophobia or internalized homophobia or whatever you want to call it with Milo, who he's sort of made a career over the last year of completely pandering to the Gamergate folks, and he seems to be expanding that to pander to men's rights activists as well. And it's difficult to know how much of it is sincere, but I think a lot of it is sincere that he really does have this.
Gaming journalism is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
That he believes a lot of the men's rights nonsense that he posts is very sincere.
Yeah. Definitely. We were just thinking. I brought that story up specifically because I think it's important to see that You know, there's this thing online right now, and I think this is a good way to wrap it up, where, you know, there's a lot of this, you know, PC culture ruining our fun, you know, social justice warriors and comedy.
Right.
And I think it's important to differentiate. I mean, you can have your disagreements with those people, and that's one thing.
Right.
But I think, and, you know, that's someone like a Joe Rogan, who isn't, you know, but he's willing to listen and pick a side that way. But I think it's important what, like, again, what someone like you do with We Hunted the Mammoth is that there's a difference, and they are trying to, as you see with these overlapping of different reactionary movements, they are definitely trying to bring in young people who see this, you know, PC culture or social justice warrior, boogeyman, and they use that to try to get, and they're successful many times, especially again with young men. And I think that's the most important part to bring up, because there's a difference. And the best way to sort of put a stop to this stuff before it gets even further into the mainstream, like we're seeing, is definitely to differentiate that. Like, you could have a problem with PC culture, and, you know, I want to say this joke or whatever, but you should know the difference. You should know what that joke means to certain groups and how they use that as a rallying cry to actually put forth things that were, they, for example, they hope that it is policies that actually hurt people of color, of a certain gender, race, such and such.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it's clear that like white supremacist types are absolutely trying to move into these movements and co-opt as many people as they can, and to take this kind of like, oh, I hate it when people censor me online, or I want to be able to say whatever I want, and they sort of feed into that and then go, oh, by the way, here's some funny anti-Semitic memes you can put on online, and we'll send you more stuff if you want to read about that, you know.
Exactly. I mean, it's like a never ending cycle.
Yeah.
So, David Futrell, thank you so much. We could go on and on. There's so much I really get to. But thanks for joining us today. That's wehuntedthemammoth.com. I'll be talking to you online. And again, follow David online.
Thanks very much.
All right. Take care.
All right. Bye.
All right, folks. That is our free half today. We will be going to the better half. We will take your calls and IMs. We have another, I would say, 40 minutes of showtime for you. Michael, someone was asking, what is that coupon code for Harry's again?
Oh, it's a majority report, but let me double check that.
We will get you that coupon code. Because I think someone saw you in the camera, and they're like, oh, I got to remember to do that. And then they saw me in the camera, and they're like, I need to do that
now.
I need to shave now. So let's go to the better half. Let's play the music. You know all the things. Become a member at majority.fm. Give us an iTunes review and do so for Sportocracy as well. You can also support this show by going to majorityreportkickback.com and buying all your Amazon stuff through there. And then Fair Trade Coffee and Chocolates at justcoffee.coop. That's .coop. Use coupon code MAJORITY and you get 10% off your entire order there. It's free shipping there too. We will see you in the better half of the program. We got some great stories, calls, IMs. Take care. Sam's back tomorrow.